From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. For the rest of this hour, a smallpox preparation update. In December of 2002, President Bush announced a plan to offer smallpox vaccinations to healthcare workers and other emergency responders to prepare the country for a possible bioterrorist attack. At the time, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, estimated that as many as 500,000 civilian healthcare workers would be receiving the vaccine in phase one of the vaccination plan. The vaccine to be used is called Dryvax. It's the vaccine that was used to eradicate naturally occurring smallpox from the world, but it's known to have potentially serious side effects, including heart inflammation. The government has also stockpiled about 200 million doses of a vaccine called ACAM2000 to be used in the event of an attack. Last week, the maker of that vaccine stopped recruiting volunteers for clinical trials after similar heart problems occurred in at least one person who got that vaccine. For the rest of the hour, we'll take a look at the status of smallpox vaccinations in the U.S. and how the problem with ACAM2000 might affect smallpox preparation plans. We'll also hear about two new smallpox vaccines under development. They promise fewer side effects, but do they work as well? Now let me introduce my guests. First, Michael Osterholm is the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota in St. Paul. He joins us from the studio of Minnesota Public Radio. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Osterholm.
Thank you, Joe. Good to be here.
It's nice to talk to you again. And Peter Jarling. He is senior research scientist at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases in Fort Detrick, Maryland. He joins us by phone. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Jarling. Apparently, we've lost Dr.
I'm sorry. I was on mute. There I am.
There he is.
Pleased to be here. Thank you.
Oh, those buttons on those phones. Anyway, and I should mention that we did invite someone from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta to join us. CDC is the agency that's coordinating the civilian vaccination program, but the agency declined to participate. But I guess we're going to use you, Dr. Osterholm, as something of a surrogate, since you're pretty familiar with what the CDC has been up to, are you not?
Yes, I am. I'd be happy to comment on that.
Okay, so maybe you could just start us off by putting us in the picture of where we've come in the last 15 months or so since this plan was kicked off, phase one of this plan.
Well, first of all, I think we want to take a step back just a little further to 9/11 and that day when we in this country recognized for the first time, for many, for some of us, a reminder that, in fact, there were people who wanted to do harm to the population of this country and other developed countries. And at that time, smallpox was already on our radar screen as a biologic agent that might very well be used by any number of different parties that would have had access to it in previous days. It's a disease that, for all intents and purposes, has been the lion king of infectious diseases throughout history. Well over 300 million people died from smallpox virus during the 20th century, despite the fact that it was eradicated from the world by the late 1970s, was out of the developed world by the early 1940s. And so it was a disease we had to be very concerned about. On 9/11, we had 90,000 doses of smallpox vaccine in this country that could have been used to protect our nation. Today, we have a dose for every American. And I think that particular piece of information is very, very comforting to many of us who still worry that this could be a weapon of choice. I think what we're going to talk about today is how do we use that vaccine in an era where we've not yet had anyone use the virus as a weapon, and hopefully never will. But if they do, how prepared are we, and what are these vaccines? Are there better vaccines than we had, you know, before our research program of the last 2 years, or are we still basically dealing with that same old vaccine? And I think that I have a sense is where we're going to go today.
Right. But maybe we should start and just, I mean, if assuming you know very little about this whole issue and you come along and someone says to you, look, we're worried about the president and other members of the administration say we have a concern about this. We have a vaccine that will prevent it. We have enough for everybody in the country. Why not just give it to everybody in the country and be done with it?
Well, I think, Joe, as you mentioned in the introduction, this is a vaccine that, first of all, and when I say a vaccine, we're going to be talking about several today, but let's just say for what we currently have, the Dryvax vaccine, which we've mentioned, or this ACAM2000, are basically the same of virus vaccine that we had that we used to eradicate smallpox from the world. It's a virus that is not smallpox virus. It's vaccinia virus, a very closely related virus, that when you are vaccinated with this vaccine, you basically develop protection against smallpox. The problem with the current vaccine that we have available is one that it has to be administered on the skin. Basically, you take and break the skin a number of times and introduce this, and then you have to grow this kind of virus on the skin. A scab forms over several weeks and falls off. That is a very different vaccine than we've otherwise had. What we wanted to do is get basically people in this country vaccinated who would be on the front lines of any kind of situation with the release of this virus, the smallpox virus, and make sure that we only take those people who are the fittest, meaning those who are not otherwise ill with some underlying health condition that might make them more likely to have a bad outcome getting the vaccine, get them vaccinated, and then have a plan that if we had to vaccinate the country, we could. Somebody who might be immune deficient today, we wouldn't want to vaccinate because this live virus vaccine might cause some problems. In the face of a smallpox epidemic, I think all bets are off. We'd vaccinate virtually everyone with this particular vaccine and take our chances that way. So what we're really doing is trying to balance today the risk of this vaccine and using it in the public setting and in the basic first response world versus no outbreak, as opposed to when we do have a potential outbreak, should we ever have one, and what we do with the vaccine then.
Okay. We're talking about smallpox this afternoon, and our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And just before we move on, I want to ask, so far, when the civilian healthcare workers, I think I said that 40,000 or so have been vaccinated, but considerably more than that, almost, as I gather, 600,000 people in the armed forces have received the vaccine. Has there been the kind of serious side effects that people have been worried about? Have there been from the people who've already received the vaccine?
Well, let me first of all say that you're correct in those numbers. About 615,000 military personnel have been vaccinated with this vaccine since the program began almost a year and a half ago. And it is true about 40,000 healthcare workers in this country. Really looking at the data from the Department of Defense studies, which are by far the most extensive, and these patients have been very intensively followed up, we've had 77 individuals who have had basically that inflammation of the heart that we talked about and the coating around the heart. Actually, that shouldn't have been unexpected. And we actually go back now and realize the studies that were done in the 50s and 60s and early 70s before we had the same level of diagnostic capability for heart infection or heart inflammation. We didn't have the same sensitive tools that we have today to diagnose this. You still saw that those kinds of inflammations occurred. And one of the good news is that even among the 77 in the Department of Defense study, no one died as a result of that. Everyone fully recovered. So it's not something that we obviously hope to have, we ever want to have, but it's one that's there, and it, again, is one of those things we have to weigh as to who should be vaccinated and who shouldn't.
Okay. Dr. Jarling, I wonder if I could turn to you now. And we've been hearing about these two vaccines that have been around for a while, or at least in the principle behind them of an attenuated virus that causes an immune response without causing illness, but still a live virus nonetheless. What about some of the newer approaches to vaccines? How are they looking right now?
Well, Dr. Osterholm hit the nail right on the head, as always, that the consequences of the conventional vaccinia vaccine that are seen as adverse events are a consequence of the virus replication. And if a vaccine could be developed on principles that did not require the vaccine to replicate, or at least not to create a systemic infection, certainly its safety profile would be somewhat better. And one of the vaccines that was actually produced in the waning days of global eradication in the 1960s is one called Modified Vaccinia Ankara, or MVA. MVA was actually developed by the German military and was used extensively in Germany, although at the time there was no endemic smallpox to be eradicated in Germany. So a substantial amount of safety information was developed, but there was no real demonstration of efficacy because there was no disease to be protected against at that time. However, the thing about MVA is that it is highly attenuated. The basis for its high attenuation is just now becoming apparent, but the observation was that by sequentially passaging the vaccine virus in tissue culture many hundreds of times, the virus essentially developed an ability to infect human cells, but only to have an abortive infection, so that there would be one cycle of replication after the virus was introduced into somebody's arm, and then the infection would self-cure. So the interest in recent interest at NIH and other health agencies in this country was to get MVA out of the freezer and to test whether, in fact, it was efficacious. Did it actually protect against smallpox-like disease? Now, we've only recently developed a smallpox primate model, and these studies all need to be done at the Centers for Disease Control, because that's the only place smallpox virus can be actively worked with. But monkeypox, which is a very close relative of smallpox virus, almost as virulent as smallpox virus, is a virus that can be worked with under less stringent levels of biocontainment. And we have immunized monkeys in our laboratory with the MVA strain and tested them against the very strenuous monkeypox virus challenge. And in fact, we found that the vaccine affords very good protection, almost as good as Dryvax, although not quite as good. But certainly all of the animals that would have been expected to die otherwise had very minimal infections and survived. And given the fact that it's so much safer than conventional vaccinia, we believe that the product should probably be moved forward.
Right. And you're also working yourself on another type of vaccine that doesn't involve any kind of a live virus. Is that right?
Well, in fact, yes. There are a number of genetically engineered vaccines that have been tested. The one which appears to have the most promise is a naked DNA vaccine that we developed here. The principle of this is simply that plasmids that express the proteins thought to be the protective proteins in smallpox virus are injected on gold spheres. Actually, they're introduced by a process called gene gun. And these plasmids are introduced into the skin, and they then begin to express the viral proteins. The virus itself is extremely complex, has hundreds of proteins, but we're expressing only four of them. And we've used our animal model once again to demonstrate that this approach, which, as you say, doesn't involve the replication of live virus at all, elicits solid immunity as well.
All right. Well, I guess that's a little bit further off, but certainly something we want to keep an eye on. We're talking today about smallpox, both vaccines that prevent against it and vaccination plans for the potential of a terrorist attack. Please call us if you want to join the discussion. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go to Joseph in South Bend, Indiana. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I enjoy your show.
Thank you very much.
I had a question concerning the smallpox vaccinations that are supposed to be stockpiled. Do they have an expiration date like other medications?
Interesting question. Dr. Osterholm, maybe you can address that.
Yes, actually, they do have an expiration date, and in fact, all of the old material that we had stored away many, many years ago, the Dryvax material, has all been brought out. It's been certified again to still be effective, and in fact, additional studies that were done at the NIH has actually gone ahead and shown that we can take that old vaccine and actually dilute it out and get more doses per actual previous dose than we had before, and they're still as effective. So this vaccine is one that I would have no hesitation about using in either a setting today of better preparedness for a smallpox attack, and clearly we would use it without any hesitation should we actually have smallpox introduced somewhere back into the world.
Thanks for that answer. I need to remind people briefly that I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to another caller, Ruby, in Hillsburg, California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you much. I do appreciate the fact that these vaccines are being taken care of. But one thing I have a problem with living in California is identification of people that have something like that.
How do you mean? You mean finding out if somebody has been vaccinated or somebody has smallpox?
Well, if people are being tested for this stuff. Because I heard that the San Francisco Bay Area has the highest amount of tuberculosis servers in the nation.
Well, this is an interesting point, but you may be having a little bit of confusion, Dr. Osterholm. Maybe you can sort this one out for us.
Actually, this is actually a question that is not so far off base in terms of how would we know if we had a smallpox attack? Would we, in fact, readily diagnose it in our emergency rooms and our doctor's offices? And quite honestly, this will pose a somewhat of a problem because in the earliest days of a smallpox illness, the rashes that you might see on an individual may mimic those of other kinds of illnesses. And so that we've actually worked hard to help emergency rooms and ambulatory care facilities or places where people would see doctors on an outpatient basis in the earliest days of their illness to actually be recognized for being possible smallpox. That's how, in fact, the monkeypox outbreak of last year got picked up when, as you may recall, these prairie dogs had become infected with monkeypox from other rodents that had come in from Africa and were being sold through pet distributors. And it was there that this lesion that's somewhat similar to smallpox was actually picked up, and people recognize now we had this situation. So part of the plan, as you're asking, is very important, is not just do we have the vaccine, but do we have plans in place to first of all know that we may have been hit, and second of all then take that information and quickly get that back out to the appropriate medical authorities, to the public, and then launch quickly into an aggressive vaccine campaign if we need it.
You know, that's an interesting point. Will doctors, I mean, there hasn't been a case of smallpox in this country for quite some time. Certainly in the current generation of doctors wouldn't be familiar with it. Will they know if they're seeing smallpox as opposed to monkeypox, which isn't all that deadly?
I'm not sure if they would know that in a sense. Will they know it as a monkeypox versus smallpox? But I think what we've done right now is we've given people a sensitivity to zebras versus horses. And we want to know about any illnesses that they are seeing that they're not quite sure. Is this a zebra or a horse? When you hear hoofbeats, you normally think of horses, but this might not be. And so one of the parts of the preparedness efforts of the last several years at state and local health departments, through support from the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services, has been to actually get a really good handle on local disease occurrences, to work with your physicians, to work with the infection control professionals, to work with the laboratory, so that should these unusual illnesses be seen, that they'd be quickly detected. In fact, what's happening is just what we wanted to have happen, although it's not necessarily a good commentary on infectious diseases. We're picking up more diseases now. Well, things that were always occurring before, but only now are we recognizing they're out there.
Okay, we'll be talking more about that, but first we have to take a short break. And we'll be back talking about smallpox. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palka. We're talking this hour about smallpox vaccination. My guests are Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota in St. Paul. Also with us is Peter Jarling. He is senior research scientist at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases in Fort Detrick, Maryland. We'd love to have you join our conversation. Our number is 1-800-989-TALK, 1-800-989-8255. And Dr. Jarling, earlier you were talking about a DNA vaccine. This is a new kind of vaccine that doesn't involve a live virus. And I know it's in the early stages of testing, but how confident would people be to jump from a vaccine that's only been tested in the laboratory and only on animals, and maybe only on animals that may or may not respond the same way to a challenge of being exposed to smallpox, to using it in humans who would have to bet their life that it worked?
Well, I think this is a generic issue that applies to all biodefense vaccines. In the case of smallpox, certainly, there is, thankfully, no opportunity to obtain efficacy data in humans because humans are not being exposed to the virus. So we're dependent on animal models. The Food and Drug Administration has developed something they call the Animal Efficacy Rule, which lays out in a great deal of detail the requirements by which the animal model must resemble human disease. The disease course must be very similar. The immunological events following immunization and challenge must be similar to the human situation. And because of those parallels, one can develop a fair degree of confidence that the animal model will provide meaningful results. Studies that use non-human primates, we use either cynomolgus or rhesus monkeys for these studies, are about the closest we can come to the human challenge situation. But there will always be some doubt, of course, that the results that we obtain in the animal model don't translate directly to humans. I would say that certainly in the case of MVA, as I mentioned earlier, that was used in large swaths of the population in Germany in the 1960s, there was no efficacy data there whatsoever. But the results of our recent MVA studies have been taken with a great deal of confidence by the FDA, and I think is on the basis of those studies they're going to move forward with production.
Okay, let's invite our listeners to join the conversation. Donna in Detroit, Michigan, welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, hi. Actually, I have two questions. If you've already gotten the first one, let me know, but I didn't hear it. The first question is, you know, I'm a baby boomer, right? I was vaccinated along with multiple millions of my brethren up through the 60s. In fact, two of my children are even vaccinated as part of the usual vaccinations in childhood. Why are we now all of a sudden concerned about the side effects for a vaccine that was used literally on every human being in the country up through the 60s with negligible, if any, repercussions? The second thing is that since I have been vaccinated as a child, would my vaccination have would it provide any immunity now, were there, God forbid, an outbreak?
Both interesting questions. Dr. Osterholm, do you want to take a stab at those?
Sure. Well, first of all, in terms of the use of the vaccine prior to the eradication of the disease, actually did pose some risk to society. It was at a time when we didn't think about vaccines in the same way we do today. We're much, much more sensitive to the risk-benefit picture, with risk being something that sometimes we define one in a million or one in 100,000 adverse outcomes as being reason to be concerned. You'll find many pediatricians who actually really did appreciate the day that they no longer had to give smallpox vaccine because they did have some side effects that occurred that were serious. So we do take these very seriously. But again, if we actually have smallpox back on the face of the earth, now we're fighting against something so much more dangerous that these risks now tip in a different balance. As far as protection, I think Dr. Jarling may want to talk about that because he's actually been involved looking much more at the area of protection.
Dr. Jarling?
Well, there have been a number of studies recently published in the New England Journal that document that there is a great deal of evidence for long-term immunity in people, as you suggest, that received their vaccines as children and are now baby boomers. There is a substantial amount of evidence that there is some residual immunity and would expect to afford at least partial protection against an exposure even several decades after that first shot. That said, during global eradication, the policy was to revaccinate every 10 years. And certainly for those people at occupational risk of exposure to smallpox or related viruses, the requirement is to be immunized even more recently than that. So I think the jury is out. As with everything else, probably a little immunity is better than no immunity. But if the perceived risk is high, or real, I think it would be prudent to advise boosting anybody, whether or not they'd seen the vaccine in childhood or not.
Joe, if I could add one other thing there to that also.
Go ahead,
Dr. I think that one of the issues that we actually have taken some comfort in is, as Peter just detailed, you know, we actually probably have more protection than we once thought we might have, but the question is going to be enough. But even in the vaccine trials we've had to date, people who were revaccinated as opposed to a first-time vaccinee actually have had a slightly lower rate of side effects, suggesting that there was enough protection there that when you got revaccinated, that you didn't have this more uncontrolled replication of the vaccine strain. So that that's actually good news, too, that should we get into another situation, we would expect to see a lower rate of side effects in those who have been previously vaccinated. One last point to that, though, but we must remember we've had a whole generation since the mid-1970s when the last vaccine was used. And, in fact, in most places in the United States, it wasn't used literally after 1971. And think back, that's everyone under 30 years of age in this country who is today largely totally vulnerable to this infection.
Donna, I hope that answers your question. Let's go to Ben in Portland, Oregon. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. I just had a quick question. First of all, I love your show. Regarding when one of the doctors first, you were asking him about the dangers of the current vaccine that's being used, he only really mentioned heart problems in some people. When I read in the Journal of the American Medical Association last month that a soldier that was vaccinated, I don't recall what the vaccine was used, his wife and his breastfeeding baby developed vaccinia lesions. And I think the fact that one can get tertiary, you know, infection of the vaccinia from the vaccine is a pretty serious health risk to the families of the soldiers that are getting these, and nobody was aware of it until it actually happened. It was one of the most startling parts of the article, and I just wanted to know what the response is to something like that.
Interesting. Interesting question, Ben. Dr. Osterholm, do you know about this case?
Yes, I do. Actually, there were a number of cases where we actually had transmission of the virus from that lesion on the arm to others in close contact with that individual. The vast majority of these occurred actually in the medical or in the military setting, and unfortunately, they were all given instructions as to how to bandage these wounds, make sure that they didn't have contact with others, and yet we had a number of instances where individuals had sex partners, etc., where they were not covered and transmission did occur. Fortunately, in each one of those, there was no serious side effect in those who actually had contact with someone else. I would add where we had individuals in the medical care setting, for example, over 40,000 healthcare workers vaccinated, who actually continued in many instances to work with patients, were in the clinical care setting, did not transmit to any patients because, again, the idea of using an appropriate bandage for the time period that this lesion was there did fully prevent it. So, you know, you can't get everyone to follow exactly what we recommend, but even still, we had a very low rate of anyone transmitting this virus to anyone else.
Okay. I need to pause briefly and remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Isn't there some value also, Dr. Osterholm? I mean, I seem to remember hearing about herd immunity, where you actually are happy that other people who aren't being actively vaccinated are still being exposed in some way because they can be protected from having that experience?
Joe, that's exactly right. In the past, we've used the concept of herd immunity, and particularly with the oral polio vaccine, where, in fact, it was good that if others might have picked up the vaccine through contact with someone who was vaccinated, it would spread that. This is one where we're much more concerned about that because we want to be very discriminating about who gets this. Remember, again, we're emphasizing safety, safety, safety. So we're trying to pick those people who are otherwise healthy, who don't have, for example, certain skin conditions that might put them at a slightly higher risk of having the virus spread across their body and so forth. And even just in regard to that last caller, when you think about the risk of transmission, it only occurred in 31 out of 630,000 vaccinees. So it didn't occur frequently enough to really have any impact on vaccinating that many more people. So this is one where we want to be very discriminating, and we're hoping we're not getting transmission from one person to the other.
Got it. Let's go to Randolph in Napa, California. Randolph, welcome to the program.
Hi, Joe. Hi, guests.
Hi.
I went through the usual vaccination procedures when I was a kid. I'm kind of a pre-baby boomer, and I never had a vaccination take. In other words, I never had one where I showed the eruption on my shoulder and the indication that I was reacting and building immunity to it. And I was always told that I had a natural immunity. I wonder if I can rely on that if there's another outbreak.
Huh, interesting. Do either of you have any reassurance to offer there or any explanation for this observation? Dr. Jarlin?
Well, yeah, I can offer the observation that in the studies that were done during global eradication in Africa, there seemed to be very good correlation between a take, the lesion on the arm, and protection, and that the vaccine failures that were recorded as smallpox occurring in vaccinated populations could usually be related to a failure to take. So I'd be a little bit concerned if, in fact, I recall that my primary immunization didn't take. Having said that, I'm one of the people who gets vaccinated quite frequently, and I am so hyperimmune that I don't get a take anymore at all. Huh. So our caller either just never got vaccinated or never got a take originally, in which case he's fully vulnerable, or he's hyperimmune. And I don't know which way I'd call it if I were he, but I think I'd want to be boosted.
But in either case, living in Napa, California, we are at least presuming that his likelihood of running across smallpox is pretty small at this juncture.
I would agree with that.
I hope so. Anyway.
Right. No, I mean, the real success to all of this is if we never have to respond. But I think that as we've learned now in this world of terrorism, to be unprepared is inexcusable when you're talking about something as dramatic as what smallpox could do to the world. So I think that this is an example of, we hope 20 years from now people will look back and say, you know what were Jarlin and Osterholm doing? You know, they just scared us unnecessarily and they spent all this money. And that would be the greatest success in the world. On the other hand, should tomorrow smallpox happen, thank God people like Peter Jarlin and others are out there helping prepare us for what could happen.
Well, just on that point, we don't have very much time left, but Dr. Osterholm, not as many people have been vaccinated as we thought might be in this first phase. How would you judge our preparedness at this point?
Well, I think, again, we have to break it down into two parts, as we mentioned earlier. One, I feel much, much better about the fact that we have the vaccines today. If we need them, we have plans in place to respond quickly if we have to. What I am concerned about is we do have many what I would call frontline gaps right now, where we have many emergency rooms in this country where only a very limited number of people have been vaccinated. Following identification of smallpox anywhere in the world, Joe, we could have two cases in London tomorrow, and at that point, tens of hundreds to thousands of people will be coming to emergency rooms with rash illnesses, not knowing if they have smallpox or not. And in some instances, as we talked earlier in this show, we won't know. And I think that you're going to see a lot of healthcare workers who are going to literally flee at that point. We saw that with SARS. I have no reason to believe it won't happen now. I would urge you to look at this Sunday's New York Times Magazine section because, in fact, there's a story about that very issue and what happened during monkeypox, where in one hospital in Illinois, actually we had that very thing happen, where when a young girl was admitted with monkeypox, most of the healthcare workers fleed.
Well,
so
Dr. Osterholm, I think
we have more to do there.
Yeah, and I don't mean to leave things on a down note, but I'm afraid that's where we have to stop. I'd like to thank my guest this hour. Michael Osterholm is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota in St. Paul. And Peter Jarlin is a senior research scientist at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases in Fort Detrick, Maryland. Thanks both of you today for talking
thank
with
you.
Me. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello and Rigo Cardi in New York. If you have questions or comments, write to us at Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, New York, New York, 10036. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.